You're listening to Podcast to Practice, brought to you by Springer Health Plus IME. Podcast to Practice brings you expert-led, independent medical education discussions, inspiring healthcare professionals to maximize their learning and make measurable changes in their own clinical practice. This podcast is part of an independent medical education program entitled Awareness Advances Action, Optimizing Outcomes for Patients with Generalized Myasthenia Gravis. It is intended for healthcare professionals and is supported by an independent educational grant from Merck KGaA, Darmstadt, Germany, and UCB, Inc.
Hi, my name is Kelly Guathme, and I'm a neuromuscular neurologist at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, Virginia. And it's an honor to be your host today for this independent medical education program called New and Emerging Therapies in GMG, Going Upstream, T-Cell and B-Cell Targeted Therapies. And I have with me today Dr. Pushpa Narayanaswamy, who is a professor of neurology at Beth Israel Deaconess in Boston, Massachusetts. And I had the pleasure of speaking with Pushpa just not too long ago in another podcast on emerging therapies and specifically focusing on FcRn inhibitors as well as complement inhibitors. And then this time we'll be talking more about B and T cell therapy. So thank you, Pushpa, again for joining us.
Hi, Kelly. We really have to stop meeting like this.
Thank you for saying yes again. And so
thank you for having me.
To kick us off here, if you wouldn't mind, just briefly for the audience, going over the MG pathogenesis and really focusing on the B cells and T cells.
Right. And I think we can actually summarize the pathogenesis in pretty much one sentence. It's a T cell dependent, B cell mediated disorder. So basically, we know it's autoantibody mediated. And autoantibodies are produced by B cells. So B cells have to have a big role in that. They are the ones that actually produce the antibodies. But then they receive T cell help in order to become sort of autoreactive and recognize self-antigens and therefore produce this autoantibodies. And this T cell priming of B cell happens in the thymus in the case of acetylcholine receptor antibody-mediated myasthenia and in the peripheral lymphoid tissue in the case of MuSK antibody-mediated myasthenia.
Very good. That's a very nice, simple overview of the pathogenesis to really set the stage for the rest of this discussion. And so kind of going from there, can you help us understand the mechanism of action of some of these newer therapeutics that are targeting B and T cells? How do you think about them and classify them yourself?
Yeah, you know, given that I'm not an immunologist or a basic doctor, basic scientist, it's a little bit hard. So I've sort of figured out an easy way in my head, or at least it's easy for me, because I like to classify things and put them into neat little boxes. And going on to some of these targets on the surface of the B cells, we have already some compounds we're familiar with. For instance, the cluster of differentiation antigens or the CD antigens on the surface of B cells. And the best known, of course, is our rituximab, which is a monoclonal antibody to the CD20 cells. So let's take that cluster. And so what are some of the other drugs that are then directed towards the CD antigens or cluster of differentiation antigens? So as you know, these are expressed on different populations of B cells, starting from the pre-B cell all the way to the plasma cell and the long-lived plasma blasts that are in the circulation from the bone marrow all the way into the circulation. And they differ depending on the maturity of the B cell. So we have CD19 antigens towards which we have one drug that is directed. It's inebilizumab. And we have a recently published trial, phase 3 trial of this, which we'll talk about. And then we have another drug, which is CD40, directed towards CD40 antigen. CD40 antigen doesn't actually sit on B cells. It sits on certain other cells and sort of influences the interaction between T cells and B cells. It doesn't deplete B cells peripherally, as I understand it. And so that drug is iscalimab. And iscalimab, a phase 2 trial of iscalimab, actually did not meet the primary endpoint. So again, sort of reinforces to me how, even if we know about this pathogenesis, the drug doesn't always have to work in a disease. And then the second group of compounds that I think about are interleukins. So these are these compounds that B cells secrete, and they have pro-inflammatory or anti-inflammatory actions depending on the kind of the interleukin. And IL-6 is one of the targets that has been tried that drugs have been tried against in myasthenia gravis. Satralizumab was tried, but the phase 3 trial, although it showed a statistically significant difference in MG-ADL between the drug group and the placebo group, the point, it was just a 1.6 point difference or something. And so, you know, that was not pursued. And then we have tocilizumab, where we have, again, an interleukin-6 monoclonal antibody, where we have some open label data that it may be effective. And if I'm not mistaken, there's a phase 3 trial that's ongoing, I believe. And then the third group of compounds is, I'll be very brief with this, this is proteasome inhibitors. We know these are used in multiple myeloma. Bortezomib, for instance, the trial of bortezomib based on some open label data that it could be effective could not be completed because we couldn't recruit patients. Again, that's the story of myasthenia gravis trials, I think. Now we have some other compounds on the surface of these B cells. The B lymphocyte activating factor, BAFF, B-A-F-F, it's also called, I think, B stimulator and B cell stimulators or something like that. Regardless, the drug that was tried in this group is belimumab. Again, belimumab, the phase 2 trial did not reach its primary endpoint and therefore was really not continued. And then one interesting group of drug, which is actually was just tried in MS. Many of these drugs have been tried in MS or NMOSD before they came onto the MG realm, is something called Bruton's tyrosine kinase inhibitor. And what it does is to affect B cell signaling downstream. And tolbrutinib was the drug, but the trials were halted because of hepatotoxicity. And then finally, we have the CAR and the CAAR T cell therapies. So it's really quite interesting. The CAR cell is a little bit, CAR CAR T cell, the therapy is a little bit different. So here what you take is, you harvest T cells, you stick them with an antigen, so you genetically engineer them, and it's oftentimes DNA engineered. So it's actually within the DNA of the T cell. You genetically engineer them to go and attack the antigen of interest. So you to express an antibody that will attack the antigen of the of interest. So oftentimes it's a cancer cell, or it could be an autoimmune cell. There are also RNA-engineered CAR T therapies, which are important in the myasthenia gravis realm, especially because the DNA CAR Ts, the DNA is changed forever, and succeeding clones of these T cells continue to express the antibody to the antigen on the surface. Whereas RNA CAR T cells, cell therapies, one of which we have a pilot trial out, the results of a pilot trial out, are they are sort of are like the COVID vaccines, the RNA therapies. So the RNA that is that actually delivers the signal for the antigen or antibody does not really integrate into the DNA. So that one clone kills those cells that of interest, and then it's gone. Then you have CAAR T cell, where it's flipped. So basically, here you don't have the T cell is not carrying the antigen. Or the antibody and then going to an antigen, is actually carrying an antibody to the other antibody on the B cell. And it could be anything. For instance, the one that I was talking to you about, the RNA mediated, attacks an antibody, attacks the receptor called the B cell maturation antigen on the surface of the B cell. What is the advantage of this therapies? It's very selective. It only removes these B cells that produce the antibodies. It doesn't deplete the other B cells in this. And it's, at least in the pilot trials, seems to have long-lasting effects, although the pilot trial was not powered to look at efficacy. It was more for safety. I think that's a lot. I'll stop right there.
I know. You haven't given me a chance to say anything. I'm just kidding. So to go back up to the sort of beginning of this discussion, I do want to highlight rituximab, because I feel like that comes up a lot. And yes. You know, we're all, I think, still trying to understand how that fits in our treatment paradigm. And as you know, there have been a number of different studies investigating rituximab and generalized myasthenia gravis. So can you just speak briefly to those and then how you're viewing this therapeutic right now?
Right. So you're right. I mean, rituximab has a very checkered history in myasthenia gravis treatment. I think most of us will agree, based on really actually mostly non-randomized trials, that is quite effective for MuSK antibody myasthenia gravis. And we often use it in those patients. And those patients can have pretty severe disease. And surprisingly, it seems to have very sustained action in many of these patients. You give them one course, you can go for like 1-2 years sometimes, more in some patients without having to repeat the course. The story of acetylcholine receptor antibody-mediated myasthenia gravis is a little bit different. And the initial sort of case series, small retrospective reviews were very, were really not consistent. Some of them showed some effect, others did not show effect. And Dr. Nowak from Yale actually did the BEAT-MG study, which was a really well-done, a 52-week study that looked at rituximab in acetylcholine receptor antibody positive myasthenia gravis. And these patients, the outcome measure was really prednisone sparing at 52 weeks. Now, and that trial did not show the ability of rituximab to have a prednisone sparing effect compared to placebo. The problem is, you can't go up against prednisone. Prednisone is a big bully on the in the field. Like, it's like prednisone acts so well, it's so hard to do these studies with prednisone sparing, right? No. Now, the other problem is that, you know, we never know where in the timing of the disease or where at the level of involvement of these drugs or target of these drugs that we have to get to and when in the timing of the disease. So, and that is exemplified by the more recent study, the multicenter Scandinavian Rhinomax study. And so, as you know, there it was acetylcholine receptor antibody patients. But what they said was, basically, the reason we believe that rituximab does not help very much with acetylcholine receptor antibodies is going back to these cluster of differentiation antigens and CD19 and CD20. And we know that CD20 is expressed over a large portion of this developing B cell repertoire, but it's not expressed very much in the circulating plasma blasts and the plasma cells which actually cause the antibody to be formed. So maybe that's why it doesn't work. So these authors postulated that if you actually get these early cells early on in the disease, before they even had a chance to become plasma blasts and plasma cells and start secreting the antibody, you will actually reduce that population of long-lived plasma cells and plasma blasts that keep causing this antibody formation and therefore reduce the disease and therefore help with the disease. And so what they did was they used the drug in patients who had early disease, so much earlier in the disease. So I think it was within 1 year of onset of disease, but ocular symptoms didn't count. And they found that these patients actually had sustained effect for several weeks after just one course of the rituximab that they gave them. So again, I think that the jury is still out on rituximab. It hasn't changed my practice very much. I tend not to use it in acetylcholine receptor antibody positive myasthenia gravis, mainly because I don't know. And second, because of the advent of some of the newer targeted therapies that are freely available to us in the U.S. And I see you nodding. Perhaps that's what you do as well.
I completely agree with that. Yes, I still use it quite frequently in our MuSK population, as you mentioned, because it's so efficacious.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, I mean, kind of a natural progression is inebilizumab, you know, with the recently published data on that drug. Can you speak to that trial a little bit, the MINT trial?
Exactly. And again, we go back to our cluster of differentiation CD antigens, right? So inebilizumab sort of is expressed in more of that B cell repertoire. And it's expressed more so in the plasma blasts and the plasma cells. So, and that was the sort of the biological basis for trying this. It's also approved already for NMOSD, I believe, where it was effective. So sort of similar complement-mediated disorders, but that doesn't honestly mean a whole lot with each drug. So we got to be careful with just that extrapolation. But because of this biological basis, it was a really interesting study because it was a 26-week study and inebilizumab was given intravenously 300 milligrams day one, day 15, and at 6 months, I believe. So it's like three shots, right? The trial, the primary outcome measure, and these included both acetylcholine receptor antibody positive and MuSK antibody positive patients. And they had fairly, you know, a fairly severe disease. The MGADL, I think they had to be at 7 or 8 or something like that. Their QMG had to be 11 at least, if I get that right. Let me see. I have some notes here. 6 to 10. So I got it close, 7 or 8, 6 to 10. ADL and 11 was QMT. And so they had moderate disease. They could be on steroids up to 40 milligrams, but not more than that. And there's a reason for that. So what they did was, of course, this was double-blind placebo-controlled as usual and randomized. The randomization was stratified a little bit by QMG score, etc. But regardless, the interesting part of this trial was after a certain period after receiving the drug, after randomization, all patients underwent a forced steroid taper. And that was a pretty rapid taper in that 26-week period. I mean, it's much more rapid than I would ever do in clinical practice. And I think, you know, most MG folks, you're nodding there too. Mm-hmm. So it is pretty rapid. But and interestingly, the primary outcome measure that was for the acetylcholine receptor antibody positive group at 26 weeks, again, change in MGADL, was statistically significant. The magnitude was small. It was 1.9, but like most other trials, it's the same, like around two point difference between placebo and drug. Their subsequent analysis, secondary analysis, they looked at MGADL in the MuSK subgroup. Again, that was a statistically significant difference, around the same. They looked at QMG difference in the acetylcholine receptor antibody subgroup. That was like a 2-point difference or 2 to 3 point difference, statistically significant. But the QMG difference in the MuSK group was not statistically significant. And so they didn't continue any other analysis. So this was like a analysis where you continue your analysis of secondary outcomes and you stop at one where, you know, it's not statistically significant. You don't go beyond that. So interesting, because this happened despite the forced steroid tapering. I think a lot of information we still need to get. We need to look at that steroid taper. We need to look at what happened to the placebo group. A lot of things we still don't know. But again, quite exciting. Again, exciting because we would expect, one of the things I always wondered was, and we see that with non-steroidals, right? It takes a long time because you're supposed to go upstream and switch off that immune response. But interestingly, in MINT, this was a pretty quick response. So that was, again, something that was very interesting to me. Side effect risks, I think it's a short trial. We have to be cautious with these therapies, of course. But in the short trial, I mean, there wasn't a lot. Some patients had infusion site reactions, again, to be expected. Headache, upper respiratory tract infections, urinary tract infections, same signal, but nothing very serious. So I think that's an exciting development because that's actually the first upstream targeted therapy that we've now had a full trial on. And I think is with the regulatory agencies for approval now.
Right. There's this whole area of drug development targeting B and T cells is really in its sort of early stages. So I'm excited to see where it goes. And to that end, it's probably too early for us to determine what the risk and benefit profile is for these B and T cell therapies versus the neonatal Fc receptor antagonists and the complement inhibitors that we were talking about earlier. But do you have any thoughts about who the perfect patient is for any of these different therapies? I mean, as so many come to market, you know, how do we choose who's the right fit?
Well, your guess is as good as mine, Kelly, honestly. But, you know, if you think about it a little bit, try and think about it a little rationally. I think they are, as you yourself said, it's upstream and downstream, meaning in one, we are not turning off that immune response. We are sort of taking care of what that immune response is doing down at the level of the neuromuscular junction. So, I mean, if you think about it intuitively, right? You won't actually turn that response off. You just don't want it to keep going. For instance, we still don't know how long to give continue patients on the FcRn antagonists or complement inhibitors, right? I mean, are they supposed to stay on them lifelong? And I don't know about you, but I've had patients who initially, because their myasthenia was bad and they got better, they're like, they're so happy. But 1 year into it, they're sick of the injections. So they go from 2 weeks to 8 weeks. And then from 8 weeks, they say, okay, I'll take the daily injections because then I can travel. But they're going to get sick of those too. So that's the other factor. Is there a role then for doing both? Do we need to do both? Because if we turn off the upstream, do we then need the downstream, right? If we turn it off, are there patients where we turn off the upstream partially and then they still have effects? Can we use the... And that would be a little bit of a problem because I guess from the pharmacological aspect of it, I mean, inebilizumab is a monoclonal antibody. You know, the FcRn antagonists are monoclonal antibodies. Two of the complement inhibitors are monoclonal antibodies. So, I mean, what does that mean? You know, and especially with the FcRn antagonists, how do you give another, if they are antagonizing the native IgG combining, you know, sort of to the FcRn receptor, what are they going to do with the monoclonal antibodies, which are, you know, IgGs? I don't know. So the pharmacology of that is really not clear. So I think that is something that would really evolve. I have a feeling initially, at least because of payer, you know, regulations, we are going to end up using one or the other. You know, we still don't know the drug effect, the side effects long term of any of these groups. I mean, you know, we do know more about obviously the complement inhibitors and the FcRns mm-hmm. because they've been out for a bit. We've got open label trials. We know nothing about inebilizumab past 26 weeks. So I think the jury's still out.
Right. And I think you touched on a very important point. The dosing frequency of these drugs differs significantly. And so to me, that's one of the most intriguing things with the B-cell depletion therapeutics that are coming to market, presumably, is that there might be dosed every 6 months as opposed to daily or weekly. And so that's an interesting conversation to have with a patient to really understand what their treatment preferences are and help that also guide that decision making.
Absolutely. And then if you go to T-cell and cladribine, there's, you know, there's very little data right now. But there's a phase 3 trial coming up, and that's an oral drug. And it's not even taken every day. It's like you take 2 pills and then you take them 6 months later or something like that.
Can you please explain to the audience that mechanism of action and how that drug we think works?
Yeah. Thanks for asking. It's an interesting drug, and it's been around in the market for a long time, actually. And it's a drug that acts both on B cells and T cells. It acts on rapidly replicating cells and inhibits DNA synthesis. And it does that. And since myasthenia gravis is a T-cell dependent B-cell mediated disorder, I think it may have a role. There was a small phase 2, actually it was an open pilot trial that tried a subcutaneous form of this drug in 13 patients, and 11 of whom actually improved well. The MG composite got better. They could reduce their dose of prednisone in like 4 months. So now there's an ongoing phase 3 large trial where we're looking at an oral formulation of the drug. So they take 2 pills, I think 4 weeks apart. I may have said 15 days apart earlier. I think it's 4 weeks apart. And then they're followed for 24 weeks. And I think that would be a really great armamentarium. Because it's an oral drug and it's free, it's dosed infrequently. It does have some serious side effects that we have to be aware. It is approved for MS, and so teratogenicity, development of malignancies, and of course, like many of these drugs, bone marrow suppression and hepatotoxicity. But it seems, to be really interesting to see what that phase 3 trial shows.
And yes, it's just so exciting to consider having an oral therapy as well available to us as we've been talking about all of these injections and infusions. Yeah. So I agree. Well, that'll be very exciting to see how that plays out as well. And so, Pushpa, we've covered a lot of ground over these 2 podcasts. And so I'm curious, you know, of all the information we covered, what would be your take-home points and message for our learners today?
It's just so exciting right now to treat myasthenia gravis, but it's also incredibly difficult because we've got to stay on top of all of these developments. A lot of them are deeply rooted in immunology, so we really have to know our immunology and what we're getting at. But at the end of the day, I really think it comes down to my patient. My patient is going to tell me, not just verbally in terms of their preferences, but in terms of how their disease is doing, you know, how what I sense are their values or what their life is like with their disease. I think they're going to tell me what to use.
I agree. I always leave it in the patient's hands when I can't decide, as long as they're not going in the wrong direction. So,
right.
Yeah. So I just, again, thank you so much, Pushpa, for your time and your expertise. I always learn so much when I interview you and we chat. And so I also want to thank our audience and really encourage everyone to listen to the other video podcasts in the series and download the clinician and patient resources on the program website. And thank you again for attending Going Upstream, B-Cell and T-Cell Therapies.
Thank you, Kelly. Always a pleasure to chat with you.
Thank you for listening to Podcast to Practice, brought to you by Springer Health Plus IME. For more information on our educational programs available, visit ime.springerhealthplus.com.